Okay. Very excited to learn with everybody today. I actually wasn't asked to do this. I asked to do this. I've reached out to Sarah and Rabbi Reichman and said, well, it's Bamidbar time, and if there are any Parsha slots, I'd love to teach a piece. This is a piece that I put together for the first time last year, so this will be, I think, just the second time that I'm teaching it. It's a piece that I've been thinking about for a few years already, and I really think there's something there. I'm excited to share it with you and excited to hear your thoughts on it as well. We're going to be doing a number of things, all of which are connected. I'm going to be firstly sharing an idea or an approach which started as a legal theory paper in the early 80s from a wonderful man who sadly died very young, whose name is Robert Carver. I'm going to be sharing his idea, which I think is a really fascinating idea in general, but can also be extremely useful when we think about how to learn Tanakh. That's point number one. Point number two, we're going to be applying his theory to a number of different cases in the book of Bamidbar. My contention is that we can use his idea really fruitfully in general, but the book of Bamidbar is an especially rich source for us. We're going to look at three examples. Number three, the third thing that we're going to do on the way to doing the second thing, is we're going to touch upon a number of the big meta themes of Sefer Bamidbar, some of the key ideas that aren't just sort of fixed in a single parasha, but really run through the whole book. So let's begin. I'm excited. I don't know how many of you think of Tanakh as like your major thing that you love, Bible study. For me, for a long time, it really became a very central thing of mine, maybe my primary interest, and I learned a lot, and taught a lot, and read around it a lot. I actually have, if people are familiar with 929, the daily Tanakh study group, I actually have about 800 people who I learn Tanakh with every day through three WhatsApp groups. If anybody would like to join, they're very welcome. I'll put the link in afterwards. We're doing a lovely summer study of the book of Eov, Job. Great uplifting stuff for when the weather is lovely outside, which you're welcome to join us for. So this last generation, maybe two generations, however you'd count it, the last few decades have been just some of the greatest decades ever in the history of Tanakh study. I say that very, very passionately. I really believe it, that a number of things have happened which mean that Tanakh is studied on both a deeper and a broader level than I think it has been. I think you'd have to go back to the Middle Ages in Spain and maybe even beyond that. It's due to a number of things. I think a large part of it is to do with Israel and sort of a societal interest in it. A large part is also to do with the academy and Bible departments moving beyond what's called source criticism to actually literary techniques of the Tanakh, which have then sort of found their counterpart within more traditional areas of learning. Tricia is running a course very soon with Adele Berlin, which I can't recommend highly enough. She is really one of the world-class sort of practitioners of a literary approach to Tanakh. In my own training and background, I don't know if people are familiar with Haaretzion and Herzog, but I studied at a yeshiva, which has a teacher training college attached to it, where every day they have what's called Tanakh Yimei Yun, days of intensive study, which thousands of people, teachers and others from around the country come to. And it's just sort of a celebration of Tanakh. So as part of this, there's been the development of different techniques for reading, the idea that you know, give a person a fish, they'll eat for a day. Teach a person how to fish, and they'll eat for the rest of their life. So the idea of Tanakh reading techniques are that we can I can show you a topic, show you a technique, and show how it works in a certain section of Tanakh, and you can then apply that to a completely different area of Tanakh. Perhaps the best known example of a work like this was a man called Robert Alter, who's a professor at Berkeley, who in the early 80s wrote a book called The Art of Biblical Narrative, which is a supremely readable, accessible book, which sort of just introduces lots of techniques, and there've been many, many more. So I want to focus on one of them today, which was not written about the Tanakh in it specifically, it's in general. Man who I mentioned, Robert Carver, I believe he was at Yale. We're going to be doing the same thing as we've done in the past, where I assume you've all got the source sheet on Slack. And so if you look at it, we won't share it on Zoom, but it's the first source, and I hyperlinked to the full paper, which, if you want to spend a lovely Shabbat afternoon reading 50 pages in a law journal, it's really, really good. There are bits that you can definitely skip, but I recommend reading the whole thing. But here is just his opening piece. No set of legal institutions or prescriptions exists apart from the narratives that locate it and give it meaning. Apart from meaning, they don't exist separate from. All legal institutions, laws, prescriptions exist within a narrative. For every constitution, there is an epic. For each decalogue, a scripture. Once understood in the context of the narratives that give it meaning, law becomes not merely a system of rules to be observed, but a world in which we live. Here's Carver's idea, and within legal theory, from the little bit that I understand, it was a pretty educational, it was pretty sort of groundbreaking note. I think, yes, thank you, Robert Carver. I don't know why I always call him Carver. Thank you to Max for messaging me that. Robert Carver, let me change that on my own doc. You can all change it yourselves. The idea that laws don't exist apart from, separate from, the narratives and the societies which they are a part of. They need to be read and understood as existing within a context. And we're not going to go deep into his argument because it's a nuanced argument. He, you know, speaks about how law both sort of represents the society and the surrounding narrative, but also in some ways subverts it as well. So what it's a call to do is to not look at law in the abstract, but to look at law as part of the larger context within which it exists. Now, I don't know if any of you are in law school. I don't think you are. But as you are all people who love studying Jewish texts, and as you all know, Jewish texts, a lot of them focus on either stories or on law, on what we would call halacha or mitzvot, this can and should be a really rich and interesting prompt. Perhaps the most obvious example would be when learning Gemara. Gemara, the Talmud, is made up of, broadly speaking, two different types of writing. The first is halachic, legal. All of the Talmud's discussions about understanding the mitzvot and what their different details are. One part. The other part, what is called Agadah. Agadah, you can describe it as folk tales, as sayings, as wisdom, as things that once happened. I once asked, I can't remember who actually it was that I asked, but somebody who is a great scholar, I asked him to give a definition of Agadah, and he said, everything which isn't halacha, which is probably a good way of capturing it. But a lot of people, certainly historically, really saw these as two separate endeavors. You take somebody like Rambam, Maimonides. The Rambam, when he writes his great work, Mishneh Torah, goes through the whole Talmudic corpus and extracts what he sees to be all of the relevant legal material, restructures it, decides what the halakha is in each instance. It's a monumental work. But he sees the Agada as completely separate. He doesn't do anything at all with the Agada. The Agada plays no role whatsoever in his great work, Mishneh Torah. But what Kava is encouraging us to do is to say, wait a second, the Talmud was written consciously as an intermingling of law and narrative, of halakha and agada. The two are placed together and should be seen as in relationship with one another. The agada has got a critical role in drawing out the way in which the law is actually lived and showing its beauty and showing its limitations, showing ways, the Agada describes ways in which sort of tensions can surface which can only be told through a story. This idea, I think, is particularly interesting for us as Jews because we live with these two worlds, the story mindset and the legal mindset. We combine them together. Rabbi Sacks had a fascinating point that he once made that often sort of breakthroughs, if you like, in Jewish philosophy come through a rereading of texts. They come through a rereading of an already well-known narrative. I want to apply this to Bamidbar. That's my idea. I think that Kava's notion can be really, really rich for looking at Sefer Bamidbar. Let's take just a very simple one to start with. I put the link in the Zoom chat. This is Bamidbar chapter, well, we're going to be focusing on chapter 15, but let's go back to chapter 14 to start with. This is the story of the spies. It's a tragic story. It's a story which, on account of the report that the spies bring back, the whole generation are destined to spend the rest of their lives in the desert. They will not enter the land of Israel. Chapter 14 describes how overwhelmed with grief they are in the aftermath. Fatisa kol ha'eda v'yitnu et kolam v'yivku. They raise their voice. They cry. They say, we're going to die in the desert. They make this tragic, failed attempt to enter into the land again. That's chapter 14. I'm not going to read all of it by any means. It's a long chapter, 40 plus verses. Look now at chapter 15. Anybody want to read a few verses of it? We don't need to read all of it, but just get a sense of it. John, would you read for us?
Sure thing. From the top?
Yeah, beginning of chapter 15.
Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe l'amor. Daber el b'nei Yisrael, v'amarta lehem ki tavu el eretz moshavoteichem asher ani noten lachem. Speak to b'nei Yisrael, and when you enter, I guess that's an introductory sentence. Vasita misha la Hashem ola uzevach lafela neder ovidava
olamadecha. Good. So just the part of the second verse, John. This is what Moshe is going to say. These are instructions for when you come into the land. Ki tavo al eretz moshvotechem. When you come into the land, asher ani noten lachem, which I'm giving you. These are not instructions for the desert. These are not things which exist outside of the land of Israel. They are specific instructions, korbanot, offerings, which are going to be given in the land of Israel. We don't need to read all of them. They carry on for a while. We're told all about these, how everyone needs to do it. And John, if you then skip down again to verse 17.
Sure thing.
New section.
Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe le'mor, daber el b'nei Yisrael v'amarta alehem, b'voachem el ha'aretz asher ani mevi etchem shama.
Again, when you come into the land, here is what you need to do. Do carry on.
V'haya b'acholchem milechem ha'aretz terimu truma la'Hashem. That you, when you eat the bread of the land, you should give some of it to God.
This is called truma. Okay, whenever you eat in the land, and it will apply to produce as well, you need to take truma. You need to take tithes of the produce. Okay, this is not a halacha which exists really in the diaspora. It exists in the land of Israel. Everyone see what's just happened here? Right? Chapter 13, chapter 14 describe the failure of the Jewish people's mission to enter into the land. They are all going to die in the desert, that whole generation. The very next chapter, when you come into the land, this is what's going to happen. Not Shabbat, not Kashrut, not festivals, not things which apply whenever, but rather an immediate focus on the land itself. So maybe let's even just take a quick pause from this. I want you to go down to the bottom of the source sheet that I sent. I put the whole structure of the book of Bamidbar there, 36 chapters, right? You see it's a big mix of halakha and narrative. You have the census at the beginning, you have the offerings of the princes, you have the menorah, then you have the camp moving, you have all of these tragedies, you, the people desiring meat, Miriam and Aharon speaking ill of Moshe, the abortive mission of the spies. Then you have our chapter talking about various offerings and challah, etc. Now, the way in which a lot of our minds are programmed is, I think, you're reading a story. Oh, it's a story. You're reading a legal section. Oh, it's a legal section. Like your brain sort of like switches on, switches off between them. But surely this can't be coincidental. Surely the moment of the failure to go into the land of Israel is then immediately juxtaposed with mitzvot of the land of Israel. That can't be by chance. Going back to Cover, Robert Cover, surely we should look at those two as being in relationship to one another. Any thoughts? And anything which sort of like might something you can do with that juxtaposition?
Well, one way to settle it is that it's an out of order text sometimes, and that this was just an out of order placement.
Well, let's sort of think with it. I mean, if I understand you correctly, we'll come back to that idea at the end. An out-of-order placement means purposefully placed here rather than somewhere else. So it's worthwhile, I think, you know, we're going to see sort of like a double relationship. On the one hand, we might understand the laws better by understanding their narrative context, but something that I like to think of is that the laws themselves can serve as sort of like an internal commentary on the narrative itself. Mina, you had a hand up?
Yeah, I think this actually says something about what it means to be settled in the land.
Go on.
I think that Truma is like part of what it means to exist in this land. And so like when you enter the land, it's not just like through mud, it's like you have to like set up a system for that. You have to like actually start the beginnings of governance, self-governance.
So why should it be placed here? What's to get out of its juxtaposition? Let me show you this Ramban. Ramban, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman. So this is at the bottom of the second page on my source sheet. People see it? Ramban, Kitavo? Okay. Says the Ramban, Kitavo el Eretz Moshvotechem, when you come into the land, the verse that John read. Achar shehivtiach et habanim sheyavo el haaretz. This comes after the promise to the children, the next generation, that they will enter the land. This generation shall not enter the land because of the report of the spies. The next generation shall enter the land. Now that this promise has been made, Hishlim lahem Torah takorbanot. God continued or completed, the Torah completes the laws of these sacrifices. Shiyakrivu nesachim bavaram la'aretz, the ones that are going to be offered up when they come into the land. V'ulai haya ze'ata. Perhaps, says the Ramban, this was right now. This was given now. Lenachemam, to comfort them. Ulahavticham, to give them a sense of security. Ki hayu no'ashim lemor. People could be despairing, saying, Mi yodea, ma yihyeh l'orech yamim, l'sof arba'im shana. Who knows what's going to happen over the course of 40 years? We've screwed up massively within the first year. That's been taken away from us, the promised land. God says, okay, the next generation will go in, but who's to say the next generation's going to fare any better than their parents? V'im yichatu gam habanim, if the next generation sin as well, they also won't go into the land, will be trapped forever in an eternal desert. V'lechein ra'a HaKadosh Baruch Hu l'nachamam. God wanted to comfort them at this stage. Ki b'tzivoto otam b'mitzvot ha'aretz, by giving them at this juncture the mitzvot of the land, hivticham, he promised them shegalui lefanav sheyavoru v'yirshuota, that God knew that they would indeed come into the land. It's a beautiful comment of the Ramban. It's a gorgeous idea that the mitzvot were given to comfort them at this stage of national despair. It's a lovely idea, and it's an idea that's worth thinking about. But I also want to point out what the Ramban is doing from a technique perspective. The Ramban is taking this halachic passage, and he's saying this halachic passage has got a narrative contribution to make. It's being given at this juncture as part of the story. Don't view it as a break from the story, as if Bamidbar is like a constant toggling between channels, the story channel and the mitzvah channel. Actually, it's one whole, and this is a part of the story. These mitzvot are being given to them at this point in order to comfort them. That's my first example, and I wanted to give it as the first one because I think it's just sort of like the simplest, straight, clearly there. Any sort of thoughts at this juncture just about the idea in general and how it might apply? Or sort of, you know, what we can do with it? I guess I can ask, is this something that people sort of like always naturally think with, or does it strike them as something that, you know, it needs to be pointed out because otherwise you miss it? I mean, I'll say just like when I'm in shul listening to the Torah, like definitely like my mind will switch on or switch off between narrative parts and between legal parts, right? Sort of, you know, you're no longer listening to a story, you think, but.
Yeah, I guess it's weird to think why a specific halacha was given at a specific time or a specific mitzvah. Like, if that does play a part, then it really opens up a whole new reading.
Absolutely. Okay, let's do a different one. This is the one which is probably the most tenuous, but I want to suggest it. I think it's a really interesting one. Go back to the bottom of the source sheet, where I've put all of Bamidbar here. You see that the numbers refer to the chapters. What would you say is the first halachic section in Bamidbar? There are many. What's the first one? Yeah, Hariel?
Sota and Nazir?
Yeah, exactly. Great. Sota and Nazir. They are early on, chapters 5 and 6. And again, they seem a little bit out of place. The beginning of Bamidbar is very much about order, about regiment, the census, each one of the tribes in the place, getting ready to move. And then suddenly, early on, that is curtailed by the very distressing story of the Sota, woman who is suspected of adultery by her husband, and Ruach Kina, a fit of sort of jealousy or rage comes over him, and there is this ritual that is to test whether or not she has been faithful or not. What is that doing here? I want to put that question out there, and we're going to draw back a little bit from it. What is the Sota section doing at that early juncture? Because it's going to be interesting that it's the first one, right? The first one placed there. Let's zoom out broadly. Hands up, vote. Bamidbar, wonderful, uplifting book or depressing, tragic book? What is it? I'm terrible at lip reading at the best of times, Khana. So on mute, I can't get anything from...
Face value, it's quite depressing.
What? Go on. Give us an argument.
It's just like stories of constant complaining and doing things wrong and then being punished for it. And I guess the more positive elements, for the most part, are mitzvot rather than occurrences.
Okay, good. Thank you. Anyone want to give a different argument? I mean, it's clear what Rechan is coming from, right? You know, Korach, the spies, like, one after another. Anyone want to give an alternative claim? Yeah, Aaron.
It's hard, I think,
I'm
for
just
me
going,
just to...
As you're speaking, I'm just going to my bookshelf to get something off the shelf. Go on.
I don't know, it's just kind of hard for me to understand it as a standalone book and look at it objectively in that way. I just view it as part of the broader narrative of the Chumash, which, you know, does in a sense have a happy ending. So I guess it doesn't, I mean, I agree in theory with what Hannah's saying, but it just doesn't feel as much of a downer to me because it's, you know, all part of getting to the land in the end.
Right. Okay, so do you see I put some hyperlinks in the source sheet? About here we're doing metatheme 1, right? And we're going to look at 2 verses later on in Tanakh, right? How are we to look at the desert experience? Look at Tehillim, first of all, okay? This is the introductory piece to Kabbalat Shabbat. Lechuna Ranana, this is. Rabbi Henkin, of blessed memory, had a wonderful essay about how often tunes in liturgy are completely at odds with the content of the verses or the text that they are singing. I mean, you don't need to know anything more than the title. The title was Who Will Live and Who Will Die, tra-la-la-la-la. which is a great, great piece. So we have a weekly version of that. If anyone has ever been to a musically inspired Friday night, the end of the first paragraph is sung, you know, often with a beautiful, uplifting tune. If you've ever read the words, what is actually being sung about is, I don't know if anyone wants to try and put it into English, into the tune, right? For 40 years, I was provoked by that generation. 40 years, provoked by that generation. I said, Am to'elev avhem, they are a senseless people. Lo yadu derechai, they do not know my ways. From the point of view of God, as described in Tehillim chapter 95, exactly as Hannah said, this is 40 years of frustration, 40 years of a people not living up to what is expected and hoped for of them. Perhaps that's the standard one. But take a look now at Yirmiyahu. This also has a significant place in liturgy. This is at the center of the Kedusha section on Rosh Hashanah. Yirmiyahu, chapter 2. Ko amar Hashem, thus does God say, Zacharti lach chesed ne'urayich, I remember the kindness of your youth, Ahavat kelulotayich, the love of your bridal days, Lechtech acharai bamidbar, el eretz lo zirua, you followed me into the desert in a land unsown. In the hands of Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah, when he's looking back at the desert experience, the metaphor that comes to him is that of marriage. And not just marriage, it's harmony, it's intimacy, it is a time without any external reflections, before the messiness. It's a couple looking back on the first days of their relationship, that intimacy that's there. Now you might say, okay, beautiful, Mr. Jeremiah, but how does that actually work with the book? I think sort of a pshat response to that would be, well, the book describes 40 years, and most of those really bad events, you know, the spies, chapter 13, 14, that's the second year, right? You know, the majority of the time is silence. Like, we you know, it's, you know, the 40-year period is actually perhaps a much calmer, simpler piece. And, you know, there's just a, if you look in between the cracks, if you look into the gaps, then, you know, there's a lot of harmony and beauty there. So Yirmiyahu versus Tehillim presents two very different takes on the book of Bamidbar. Let's go back to Sota now. I want to show you something quite cool. We're doing a lot of jumping around through through Tanakh in a moment. If you go up to the, this is the top of the second page, you see where I've put Sota. You see that I've put a link to Shemot chapter 32. Click on that link. I hope you're all experienced enough with Zoom and Safari by now to not find this difficult, jumping from one text to another. Shemot chapter 32. People have it? We are aftermath of the golden calf. Egel Hazahav. Moshe has come down the mountain, sees the people cavorting below. Furious, he smashes the tablets. What happens now? Aaron, would you read for us verse 19?
I am still pulling it up.
Yeah, that's fair.
This Shemot is 32:19.
Exactly.
Vayhi kasher karav lamachane, vayar ta'egel umecholet,
ויחר אף משה וישלח מידו את הלוחות וישבר אותם תחת ההר. And when Moshe approached the camp and saw the calf and the dancing, and his anger was kindled, and he threw or sent from his hands the luchot and shattered them at the base of the mountain.
Okay, carry on.
Vayomer Moshe el Aharon, Ma asalacha.
Vayikachta egel, you skipped a verse.
Oh, sorry. Vayikachta egel asher asu vayisarof ba'esh. ויתחון עד אשר דק ויזר על פני המים ויושק את בני ישראל. And he took the egel that the people had made and burned it in fire and ground it up until it was fine and threw it into the water and made the people drink it.
Does that remind anyone of anything? Moshe takes the calf, smashes it up, grinds it down, dissolves it in water, and then makes the people drink. Anyone ever noticed that before? Ain't that cool? Isn't that awesome? Let me, I will do one share screen. Here is the Rashbam. It'll be Shlomo ben Meir, the grandson of Rashi. The Rashbam noticed it as well. Vayashkit b'nei Yisrael. He gave it to Israel to drink. Badkan kasotot. Checked them. Made them submit to the test of sotah. Of course, fascinating that, you know, we don't know what a sotah is at this stage in Shemot. It's never been mentioned. How fascinating is that? The Jewish people as a whole are subjected to the Sotah test. When you think about it, though, it's not actually so surprising, because we know that this metaphor of a relationship, as we actually, you are the same group. We spoke about this a lot with Michael Wishergrad. This idea of a relationship, and in particular a what we call in Shir HaShirim Dod V'Raya, not parental parent-child relationship, but actually relationship of lovers, is a very, very deep-rooted metaphor. You might have heard of Har Sinai as a chuppah, at which the Jewish people marry God or marry the Torah. We've just seen Yirmiyahu, who uses that metaphor explicitly ahavat kululotayich, the way in which you loved me when you were a bride. Well, the metaphor goes both ways, right? It's a beautiful, lovely metaphor when things are good, talking about the love between Israel and God, but it's also a relationship which captures deeply that sense of betrayal if there is disloyalty involved. And that seems to be not even something which is a later comment. It seems to be internal to the Torah itself. The Torah seems to be purposefully paralleling here the Jewish people as a whole to the case of Sotah. People familiar with Aviva Zornberg? People know her name? Oh, glad to see most people nodding. Okay, that gives me that makes me happy. Aviva is wonderful. She is, I think I would call her a friend, honored to call her a friend. When I lived in Yerushalayim, she would have me over a lot. She is one of the greatest teachers of Torah today. Truly great mind, creative thinker, powerful writer, wonderful person. She has a book on Bamidbar. I've put a quote from it on our source sheet. This is from, I think, the introduction to it. Below the Ramban that we read before. So this would be page 3. Sam, would you read it for us?
Sure. At the heart of Sefer Bamidbar is the ambiguity of the issue of trust. The treachery of the Sota, the woman suspected of adultery, is itself the subject of an uncertainty that the ordeal is to resolve. Is she guilty or innocent? What is she? But it turns out, no, absolute certainty is to be had. In human affairs, the field of inquiry is never sterile. The wife may have other virtues that cloud the issue, but the husband may have a history of his own that will block the elegance of the proof. If she is innocent, an incomplete certainty frees her from suspicion. If she is guilty, she may confess and thus avoid the dissolution of God's name. In the beginning of the book, the tone is set for the bewilderments of uncertainty, denial and mistrust for a better dissolution of meaning where certainty is not to be had.
Now, do you see what she's saying? You see how cool that is? Go back to our question, right? Our sort of technical question. What is the passage of Sota doing so early on in the book of Bamidbar? It could have occurred anywhere in the Torah from the beginning of Shemot to the end of Devarim. Why is it located at this juncture in the book of Bamidbar? It's the very first halachic passage in the book of Bamidbar. And following on from Robert Cover's nudge, what is its contribution to the narrative? So Aviva is, I think she's, I'm pretty sure she's saying this, just not making it quite as clear as, you know, I want to emphasize. The passage of the Sota is placed at this juncture, at the beginning of the book of Bamidbar, to essentially ask the question of the people as a whole. We've already seen at the end of Shemot how the Jewish people are paralleled, portrayed as undergoing the Sota test. That is the question of the book of Bamidbar. Are the people going to live up to their mission? Are they going to fail it? Is it all actually too murky in order to have, as she says, an elegant proof? Nevertheless, that question of loyalty or disloyalty is the ongoing undercurrent of the book as a whole. By placing it so early on in the book of Bamidbar, this whole sort of sense of order and regularity and numbers is disrupted, and it's not broken, but it's disturbed, and there's that question mark which is planted early on, and it's going to sort of lay the groundwork for everything that's going to come. Perhaps it's going to be like Yirmiyahu says. Perhaps it's going to be a beautiful, glorious relationship. Or perhaps it's going to be like Tehillim, and it's going to be 40 years of disloyalty. So I think that's really cool as a second example of sort of applying Cover's theory to Bamidbar, that the halachic sections are not simply halachic sections, they have their own contribution to make to the narrative. Okay, cool. That's our second example. Guys, you all know me by now. Interrupt me at any point. Raise your hands, say your questions, speak them out. Don't be shy to, okay? Any thoughts on it? Yeah, please, Ariel.
Can you say that the Nazir also, at this point in Bamidbar, has sort of the same role of interrupting? Like, we start Bamidbar, we have this census, we're talking about the nation in general, and then after we have Sota Nazir, we have the long list of, like, the Korban that all of the tribes are going to bring. Very, like, national sense, and then we have this disruption with sort of these two exceptional figures, though Nazir and Sota are very different.
So go on. What would the Nazir be doing there then? What's the contribution that Nazir makes to the narrative or the contrast?
That's a good question that's sort of like half-baked right now in my head. I mean, I think like the Sota in terms of loyalty can make sense. I think with Nazir, there's also the question of loyalty and also like keeping the Nazirite vow, that it's like something very serious and puts you on a different plane than sort of the average person, and that comes with greater responsibilities and risks.
Yeah, fair. Nicely said. Thank you. That's definitely worth thinking through. John.
In my experience of the Gemara, Agadah usually comes after the Halakha to, like, modify or limit it or comment on it in some way. But these examples have the narrative before the Halakha. So is there... are both of my generalizations generally true? And does that mean that the direction of the commentary is primarily in one direction and opposite directions for both of them?
That's a great question. I don't think it is. It may be a general pattern in Talmud. It might be. I don't think it's if it is, though, it's certainly one which has got a lot of exceptions to it. Although, no, I do see what you mean. You know, a chapter, perek, can often have its agada sort of loaded towards the end. I'm gonna think on it. Okay, I'm not sure that our data set is big enough to draw big conclusions from. But thinking about it, just
from a cursory look at the outline to Shmoot and my limited experience with Gemara in general.
Right. In this, the next one, we'll see it's the halakha does come first. I'm gonna want to suggest. Okay, so let's look at our third example. This is the Parah Aduma, and it's this week's Parashat Chukat. I put the link, the Safaria link, in the chat. So this is the Parah Aduma, the red heifer, this sort of perfect, unblemished calf, which has got a fascinating role of responding to Tumat Met. Tumat Met, the impurity of the dead, or someone who's come into contact with a dead body. And here it is, dropped down in the 19th chapter of the book of Bamidbar, a full chapter on it. Famously, it makes pure those who are impure, and it makes impure those who are pure. It's something which has sort of excited a lot of imagination. I don't know if anyone's read The Yiddish Policeman's Union by Michael Chabon, which has got a nice focus on the red heifer. And it has a fascinating, opening. Zot Chukat HaTorah. This is the law of the Torah of... pardon me, I actually wasn't thinking of that verse. A few verses later, of one who... Zot Torah HaAdam Asher Yamut Ba'ohel. This is the Torah of a man, verse 14, who dies in a tent, which sort of becomes, you know, a famous phrase in Midrash that's used as a phrase that sort of describes, you know, the nature of all people is that they will die. Mortality is the ultimate common experience for all of us. Zot Torah Ta'adam, this is the Torah of man, Yamut Ba'ohel, we will all at one point leave this world. Okay, so what's it doing here? Why is it here? Again, like we did with the Sotter question, want to park it for a few minutes. Just leave it in the background. The background question is, what is Para Aduma doing at this juncture? Let's go to the next chapter. Chapter 20. Okay. This is a chapter primarily associated with what's called Mei Meriva, Moshe's striking of the rock. The people cry, the people complain, Miriam has died, they don't have water, they cry out to Moshe, and Moshe flips. Moshe can't take it. They say, why have you brought us to this juncture? Why have you taken us out of Mitzrayim to kill us in the Midbar? And Moshe responds to them as follows. God has told him to take his staff and to speak to the rock. Moshe takes his staff, and now I'm at verse 10. But before he hits the rock, or speaks to the rock, he says, Shimuna Hamorim, listen to me, you rebels. Will I bring water forth from this rock? And he raises the staff, strikes the rock, water comes out. The people drink. You'd think everything would be happy, but verse 12, the critical one, Yomer Hashem el Moshe el Aharon, Ya'an lo he'emantem bi, since you didn't believe in me. Lehakdisheni le'enei b'nei Yisrael, to sanctify me in the eyes of Israel. Since you didn't do this, Lachein lo taviu et hakahal hazeh el ha'aretz asher natati lahem, you shall not bring this congregation into the land. This is this week's parsha. If the people as a whole are denied entry into the land because of the sin of the spies, Moshe and Aharon are denied entry into the land because of this episode, the striking of the rock. And of course the question is, what was so wrong? What was so terrible about what they did? The punishment seems to greatly outweigh the crime. Okay, they struck the rock. All sorts of responses to it. Rashi says he should have spoken to it, not struck it. Rambam says it's about anger. Anger is the most terrible of sins, and because Moshe gave in to anger, therefore this happened. All of these are very localized responses, and you're still left with the impression that the punishment doesn't fit the crime. The punishment is greater than the crime. In Midrash, in fact, the authors of the Midrash are troubled by this question so much that they actually add additional reasons. They locate elsewhere reasons for why Moshe can't go into the land. Perhaps it goes back much earlier to his original refusal or hesitation to take up the mantle of taking Israel out of Egypt. Lots and lots to say about Midrash. Class for another time. I want to offer a different answer. An answer which focuses actually on the structure of the book of Bamidbar and the context. I've put the introduction of the Netziv to Bamidbar here. People familiar with the Netziv? The Netziv is Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. One second, I'll go and grab it just so you can see what it looks like. He was the great head of the yeshiva of Volozhin, the great yeshiva of Europe in the 19th century. His commentary on the Torah is called Emek Davar, a wonderful, very important commentary. Highly recommend it. Aviva Zornberg loves him, as an aside. He writes beautiful introductions to each book. The book the introduction to the Book of Bamidbar, which I've put on the source sheet, he writes as follows. He says, "This is the story of two generations, the generation which left Egypt and the generation which entered the land." Listen to this midrash. Ready for a powerful midrash? Vayavdel Elohim ben ha'or uven ha'choshech. God separated between light and darkness. Amar Rabbi Simon, ze sefer bamidbar. Said Rabbi Simon, this verse, God separating between light and darkness, refers to the book of Bamidbar. Shehivdil HaKadosh Baruch Hu, ben dor sheyatza mimitzrayim ledor shenichnas la'aretz. Where God separated between the generation which left Egypt and the generation which came into the land. There is a census at the beginning and there is a census at the end. The census at the beginning is the census of the first generation. The census at the end is the census of the second generation. You almost don't notice it. It seems to not be explicit on the surface. But not a single person included in the first census is included in the second census. There has been a complete turnover. Light and darkness, two different generations. In many ways, and I don't mean this to sound as tragic and macabre as it's going to sound, it's a book of death. It's a book of one generation dying and a new generation taking this place. Now here's the really interesting question. Okay, very nice, the Netziv is correct, I get that. But where does it take place? Where's the moment where we stop talking about the first generation and we begin talking about the second generation? I love the Netziv's idea that it's the story of two generations, but where is the point where it ends? And the answer is, and the Netziv says this very briefly, he doesn't go into it, the answer is our chapter. Okay, this is really cool. How does the chapter begin? What's the first thing in the chapter? Chapter 20, before the striking of the rock. What's the first verse? What happens? What's significant about that first verse?
Miriam dies.
Miriam dies is one thing. Another thing is it's a journey, and you've got a date stamp. Date stamps are important. We're told it's the first month. We're not told what year, but we can work out that it's the 40th year. Miriam dies at the beginning of the chapter. At the end of the chapter, Aharon dies. In the middle of the chapter, Moshe is told that he will die. This is the chapter, chapter 20, the death of the leaders of this generation, of the first generation, and presumably with that, of the generation as a whole. Shimuna Hamorim, says Moshe, verse 12, or verse 10, was it? Listen to me, you rebels. You see the problem? Moshe is treating them exactly as he treated their parents. Moshe does not realize that this is a new generation. He's referring to them with the same playbook as the old generation. He was the great leader of the previous era, who took the people out of Egypt, led them through the desert, went up Mount Sinai, but he's not able to communicate with this next generation. He's using the staff, the symbol of that previous generation's leadership, which is out of place with this new generation. You want a really cool, close reading midrash? Look at verse 12 again. I love this midrash very much. Ya'an lo he'emantem bi. Since you didn't believe in me, God says, lehakdisheni, to sanctify me, le'enei b'nei Yisrael, in the eyes of Israel, Lechain, therefore, lo taviu et ha-kahal hazeh. You shall not bring this kahal el eretz asher natati lahem, to the land which I'm giving them. What generation? What kahal? The second generation. You shall not bring this younger generation into the land. Says the Midrash, a different generation you shall. Their parents' generation, who will have all died in the desert, who will all be buried in the desert. You will be buried amongst them. There will come the day, Bi'amot HaMashiach, where you will lead them into the land. Et HaKahal HaZeh, this second generation you shall not bring into the land. Their parents' generation, you will. So I think that's really the most compelling explanation for why now the crime does not outweigh, is not out of sync with the punishment. It's almost not a punishment. It's just Moshe is not of this generation. He can't speak to them. We have this throughout history of a great leader of a previous generation no longer being compatible with the next generation. Let's go back to our question. What is chapter 19 doing there? Why is Para Aduma, the red heifer, dumped in to Bamidbar at this juncture? And the answer is clear. Because what is Para Aduma? Para Aduma is Mataher Tame Metim. It is after interaction with those who have died, the way in which we move on, the way in which the impurity of Tumat Mate is replaced by purity. The whole generation has died. All of the parents' generation are no longer with us. The halachic section of Para Aduma is deployed at this moment to mark that passage between the first generation and the second generation. The first generation have passed on. The laws of Tumat Met and Para Aduma are given, and we are now in a second generation. I want to conclude with something really whack. We read Robert Cover. We read a few lines from his wonderful piece, Nomos, a Narrative, published in the 1980s. But guess what? Long before Robert Cover lived the Chizkuni. France, in the Middle Ages, racked by the Crusades, Yale Law Journal was still a very distant twinkle in someone's eye, but the Chizkuni wrote in about 2.5 lines essentially what Robert Cover was going to write. Very bottom of the source sheet, the final source. Towards the end of Shemot. Shemot, chapter 34. Moshe summons Aharon and all the elders to him, instructs them with everything. The Chizkuni is interested, as many are, in how did it actually work? What was given at Mount Sinai? How was it relayed? What's the connection between Mount Sinai and the Torah text that we have? Watch this. Kol mitzvot shina amru ba'arba'im yom rishonim ba'arba'im yom achronim. Moshe got the mitzvot, didn't he, in the 40 days, the groups of 40 days when he was up the mountain. V'chol mitzvot shenitztavu Yisrael ne'emru minisan shebo yatzu Yisrael mimitzrayim. All of the mitzvot was said from when Israel left Egypt in the month of Nisan until the 20th of Iyar in the second year. Aval, but, HaTorah Megila Nitna. Might have heard this phrase before, Megillah, Megillah, Nitnu. The Torah was given in scrolls. It was sort of given in chapters, as it were, deployed in chapters. That's an important phrase from the Gemara. Shelefi shehaya Moshe shomea hamitzvot mipi HaKadosh Baruch Hu. As Moshe would hear the commandments from God, he would write each one down on its own scroll. God would tell Moshe about Shabbat, Moshe would write about Shabbat. God would tell Moshe about Kashrut, he would write about Kashrut. And he'd keep them all. He'd have a mitzvot section, or a mitzvot box that, of the mitzvot that he'd received from God on Har Sinai. Uchshabar lipater min ha'olam. And when it came time for Moshe to leave the world, Sider Sefer Torah, he ordered the Torah, you already had the narratives, the Kava bo ha'parshiot, and established the different sections, Ad Hayom Hazeh, I think that means either until this day or it means until the text in this day, Lefi ha'smuchin, or simuchin ha'ru'uyin lahem, based on the appropriate smuchin, the appropriate juxtapositions, the appropriate points in the text where adding the halachic narrative at a certain juncture would make sense, would add to, would comment on the story that was being told at that time. There we go, everyone. I hope people enjoyed that. I realise we're a bit after the hour, I apologise. So I will please ask you, do in the Slack channel, either to everybody or to me, message me your thoughts. I'd really, really love your thoughts. But I hope we've seen how Robert Cover's idea of nomos and narrative can be extremely useful as a way of reading Tanakh, and is especially rich in the book of Bamidbar. Lovely learning with everybody. Thank you all so much.